Welcome to Tales from the Dance Floor, a podcast exploring the lives and times of people from all walks of life who followed their passions and made careers out of DJing, producing, parties, dance culture, and the music industry. I'm Phil Morse from Digital DJ Tips. Let's get started. I have a friend, colleague, and someone who is quite likely well known to some of you, Dan Tate, with us today. And the reason Dan's probably well known to you is that for many, many years, Dan has been the voice of Pioneer's online interview radio station, and he has interviewed some of the greats in DJing and in music. Hello, Dan.
Good evening, good afternoon, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm absolutely fine. It's a pleasure to speak to you, Dan. It's so nice at the end of a busy day to lock the door, turn off the phone, and just chill out and chat DJing with friends, which is what this is all about. So thank you for taking the time to talk to me. And Dan, you, in the time I've known you, just looking at the last few weeks, have interviewed some of the great DJs, some of the great names, some of the great performers in this game. Just literally in the last few weeks, you've talked to Rui Da Silva, Left Field, Mr. Switch, and looking back, there must be some names that you think, even now, wow, I got to interview this person or that person. Who sticks out for you as someone, a few people who you've really, you just can't believe you had the chance to spend some time with and talk to on your radio show for Pioneer DJ?
We've done over 100 episodes and each one has been intriguing. But I think, you know, meeting your childhood heroes, you know, are always going to stand out for you. And to hear their stories firsthand when they're sat next to you. And, you know, in the studio, it's very cozy. We share a mic. So, you know, it really is, you're looking into the whites of their eyes. And so story, you know, DJs or artists that really jumped out to me. One of them was David Morales. That was really special because, you know, he's a complete legend and I've loved his remixes and original productions since, you know, my teenage years. And to hear him talk lucidly about playing at the Paradise Garage and how he started off in Brooklyn and, you know, doing those remixes in the 90s for like Mariah Carey and Shabba Ranks, and hearing those stories face to face when there's just two of you in a room is really special. Likewise, Jazzy Jeff talking about block parties and learning how to scratch and where he got his records from and being influenced in Philadelphia by the DJs in New York. When it's just two of you in a room, you know, just having those moments of connection, you know, they've been some of the best moments of my professional life.
So, Dan, you're a DJ. We're all DJs, right? If we had to write down what we do, we'd probably still have DJ somewhere in that line underneath our names, no matter what we end up doing with the majority of our time. And was it DJing itself that got you into this game in the first place? Did you want to be a DJ before it developed into what you ended up doing?
It's a really strange question because I think it's something that gets asked quite a lot to different artists. But I've never really thought about it too much myself. Because when I think back, I think I've always just had a really deep love of music. And when you love music and you really feel passionate about a certain piece of music because of the way that it stirs your emotions, you want other people to feel that way as well. And whether that's something that's happy, sad, melancholic, or, you know, you want to stir those emotions in other people because it stirred you. So I kind of got into DJing just by having a music collection, I think, was the first and foremost thing. And I was fortunate or lucky enough to have elder brothers and sisters who were really into music. So even from a really young age, it's not that I came from a fantastically musical family, but people in my family did love music, and so they shared that music with me. And so the idea of collecting music was completely natural. And then wanting to share that music, I fell into DJing almost by accident.
So tell us how it happened, Dan.
Well, I actually wanted to go to the older kids' parties when I was young. And, you know, even a gap of, like, you know, just being the school year above is a massive degree of separation. And I wanted to go to these parties, but I thought, you know, they're not just going to, like, let me in if I just turn up. So I thought, well, if I buy a disco light, like I got a strobe, then it would be like, okay, yeah, you can come in. You know, you're adding something to the party. So I purchased a strobe, and that kind of opened the gateway to, like, going to more parties. And then I thought, what else is a cool light? So I got an ultraviolet, and then obviously, you know, in the 90s, that's great fun. You know, your teeth turn a funny color and fluoro stuff really stands out. And then I kind of started ending up going to a lot of different, you know, obviously these are kids' parties, you know, no clubs or anything at this point. And but then someone said, well, you've got this disco gear, like, can you come and DJ for my party? And so I didn't kind of learn to mix or, like, you know, kind of think, oh, I want to be a DJ. I just said, oh, okay, I'll come along and play some music. And I remember kind of the night before going, this can't be too hard. I mean, literally, you're turning something up while you turn something down. There can't be that much more to it. And I already had the music, so I kind of just started playing people's parties. And then, you know, that was kind of early 90s, like 91, 92 or something. At the time, I was, like, listening then to, like, hardcore tapes, like rave tapes and stuff. And then I'd kind of discovered house music, 94, and that's when I first started going to clubs. And then the kind of the journey of learning to mix, and, you know, really took a hold of me.
So thinking back to those early days, how old were you when you were taking your lighting? Which, by the way, I've never heard of anyone getting into parties by taking the lights. That's the first. It's awesome. So I've often heard some bizarre stories about getting into parties. One of my favourites was someone said you can get into any nightclub anywhere if you have a box of oranges. And clearly it's kind of, well, how do you do that? And you just march up to the door saying, I've got the oranges for the bar. Oranges or lemons, some kind of fruit you'd have in a cocktail, right? And he said it never fails. He'll always let you in. So there you go. But you turned up with strobe lights and ultraviolet. Still fun today, right?
Yeah.
So how old were you?
Well, I think I must have been about 13, because I don't think I was, like, in my first year. I think maybe I was in my second year of secondary school. So.
And where was home? Where was this?
Well, this was at a boarding school in Sussex. So it was a rather strange setup, because it meant that, you know, that at the weekends you kind of wouldn't go round each other's houses because you're all there. So it's the perfect setup to kind of start parties, because you just had this, you know, you had this setup where everyone was living on campus at the time. So yeah, it was a unique setup. Something that I must explain now, and I don't kind of, you know, want to take away from anyone, you know, who does go to a boarding school or has been to a boarding school, but the school that I went to was called Christ Hospital, and it's pretty unique because their mantra was or their ethos was to accept lots of different children from different walks of life. And the way that they did that was by putting an income bar on people who could go to the school. So if your parents earned too much money, you weren't allowed to go there. So what this meant was that you had, like, loads of kids that wouldn't normally have gone to somewhere like a boarding school going to a boarding school. So it was also co-ed, so there were girls there as well. What then happened was that, you know, I started DJing at these parties, and, you know, because there was a hunger for parties at that time, you know, there wasn't kind of, you know, computer games weren't as rampant as they were, as they are now, and, you know, no one had any mobile phones or anything like that then. And so, you know, your kind of modes of enjoyment or spending your free time was like, you know, watching terrestrial TV, or video at the time was still quite special. So then, you know, after that, it was kind of like music and sport. So, you know, music featured quite highly in, I think, you know, most teenagers' interests at that time.
And so you're DJing at boarding school parties in a mixed boarding school where there's kind of a level playing field of the kind of people there, because the elites have been locked out. And when I first started DJing in clubs, so reaching the stage that you're talking about, you started talking about where you'd kind of moved past this point and you're out in the clubs, one of the things that I absolutely loved about that time, and it was around the same time as you, was the fact that there was, you got all walks of life in a nightclub. So you were meeting people that you wouldn't normally meet. And back then, certainly for me in the north of England, you know, that anyone from the next town was automatically the enemy, because it's just how it was. And then suddenly clubbing hits, and then, you know, everyone's your friend. Was this happening for you around that time, that you were discovering clubs? Were you kind of hooked into this, wow, you know, we're all in this together kind of vibe? That was certainly my experience around that time.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of like at the suburban end of stuff, because basically, you know, you would go to school, and fortunately you had like quite long holidays. But I was living in Southend, or I'm originally from Southend, or near Southend in Essex. And so, you know, I wasn't like living near one of the kind of the big hubs, like, you know, London, Manchester or Leeds. But what happened then, because it was around 94 when I actually started going to clubs when I was 15. So unbelievably 25 years ago, almost to the month. Wow. What we got was the kind of the part where the Ritzies and the kind of the more commercial clubs started running house nights, you know, or underground music nights, as kind of like this kind of rave, or, you know, as the Criminal Justice Act came in 92, obviously took people off the kind of London Orbital and out of the illegal raves and pushed them into clubs. And that's kind of when you, 92, you know, you've got the birth of like Cream and, you know, the super clubs and that Handbag House era and Back to Basics and stuff like that. And so around 94, we were still getting all the kind of London DJs, or DJs from Manchester or Liverpool, etc. But they were coming to our club. But it was still like, you know, carpets on the floor, shuts at 2, and... But there was an excitement there. And going back to your original question, there was the freedom of expression. And, you know, you are all in this together. And this was something really new. And at this point, people really didn't know what to kind of make of electronic music still. You know, it was kind of, sprinklings were in the charts, but it wasn't kind of like the gigantic youth culture that it is now. So I think, you know, there was still a massive, it was still like a massive period of discovery, and bastions of kind of electronic music in terms of finding out what was on was literally, you know, there was nothing on TV. You only had the radio, and then you had a couple of magazines. So, you know, had DJ Mag, Mix Mag, you know, at the time it hadn't even really exploded. You know, there was no like Ministry Mag or Music Mag or Jockey Slut or things at that point. So, you know, it was very, very limited. So what was out there got absolutely rinsed in terms of like radio shows and magazines.
Yeah, it's a different age, wasn't it? And of course, no internet was the thing that changed all that many years later. But going back to you in your suburban life, just kind of escaping school and starting to club and starting to discover house music, when did you make the jump to one of those big places that wasn't suburban, whether it was London. I'm going to guess it was London, but you tell us. When did that happen in your life?
What, in terms of like going out raving?
Literally physically moving, literally being somewhere else, literally turning your back on it and saying, right, I'm going to move to where it's all happening. Or did that not happen for you? Were you happy where you were? How did you kind of progress to the next step of being closer to all of this?
Well, what happened was, you know, it's pretty cliche, but I went to school up until the age of 18. Then I did an art foundation course where you had to do it where your parents lived. So I had to go back and live in Southend for a year, which wasn't great. But, you know, it carried with it its own set of stories because I managed to get a residency down at a place called the Mansion House near Worthing. And I was DJing at Brown's in London and a couple of other bits and pieces up in London. But then actually moving away, I went to university in Leeds. And yes, it's cliched, I chose it because it had what I deemed to be a really amazing, exciting scene. You know, you had Back to Basics and you had Hard Times, and it just felt like there was a myriad of different places that you could go out and hear different forms of electronic music.
And of course you could head down the M62 to Manchester at any point in your life should you have wanted to, right?
Exactly.
You're not a DJ now full time. You have a job that you've done for a long, long time, 16 years. You just shared with us, I think you shared it or I looked it up before the podcast. It's a long time to be working where we know you, kind of for or with Pioneer. So I guess there's these few years that lead up to that section of your life. And I'm assuming that you still like to DJ. You still carry that passion for music, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say that even my passion for music has like increased, and it's actually grown broader since I haven't been playing regularly, because I think when you are playing regularly, you're constantly like, the magpie in you is like, oh, what, you know, what do I need to be discovering, you know, what should I be playing? And I think once you kind of take that kind of necessity away of like finding new DJ tracks, your taste just becomes, well, for me it just became so much more broader, because there was no pressure to continually hunt down music for DJing.
That makes a lot of sense. At what point did you decide, I don't want to chase the dream of DJing for the rest of my life? Or was that ever your dream? Was there a turning point in your life that something changed, kind of a crossroads?
You know, I look back and, you know, it is a tricky question to answer, because I do get asked it quite a lot, you know, do I DJ or do I still DJ? And then kind of, you know, I say, well, I'm not playing out regularly. And because I don't think anyone says I'm not a DJ anymore, you know, because I think in your heart of hearts, if you enjoy mixing and playing music and you've got the ability that at the drop of a hat you could just go out and play, then you're still a DJ. So I choose to say that I don't play out regularly. But I think it was a combination of things. I was touring really heavily round about 2008, something like that, and it was a really insane schedule that I was following, and it was completely self-inflicted. You know, there was no kind of manager pushing me. It was just, I just had this deep, deep hunger. But at the same time, I also felt like, oof, you know, I'm quite lonely here. You know, this is, you know, I'm having amazing highs, but also kind of quite crushing lows. And I don't quite know how it happened, but I think I was going to take a residency at a club in Ibiza, and it just seemed really natural to move there and have this residency, you know, in a fantastic club there, and then just go and not tour as much and just live in Ibiza, which, as we know, is the kind of global thoroughfare for anyone or anything, or, you know, anyone who's doing anything in electronic music for 4 months of the year. And that just seemed like a really natural thing to do. And then at the same time, you know, I met my wife, and then, you know, we started our family. So I don't think that there was like one defining moment when I said, you know, oh, I'm not going to DJ anymore. But as Pete Tong says, you know, when we interviewed him for Slaves to the Rhythm, that children, you know, they either put the brakes on you, or, you know, you kind of lead this unnatural life, you know, because I don't think DJing and family life mix. And I've chosen family, and I don't regret it for a single second.
Do you think that life should, without getting too deep about this, Dan, do you think that life kind of like is all right working in chunks like that? It's okay to have a chunk of time doing this and a chunk of time doing that, and to kind of switch and move maybe a few times throughout your career as to something that suits you at the time. And as someone who interviews a lot of DJs who have made a life doing one thing, does that kind of reinforce your thinking that no, actually, you know, what I just described is probably better? When you look at the people who have kind of just carried on doing it without really a break and without changing their lives, do you feel jealous of them, or is it kind of like, no, I'm happy?
Oh no, well, first of all, I'm super happy, because, you know, if anything, the job that I do, and I'm not just saying this, but it marries so many different aspects of what I love in life all together in one role. So, you know, that's not even a question. But I also think that, and I've also learned that people naturally, just through the natural ebb and flow of their lives, live their lives through chapters. And, you know, everyone's got different chapters where they might have been going out with a certain person, or playing a certain sound, or residing in a certain country that suited a particular part of their life. And I don't think one person or one DJ has ever kind of, you know, just sat still and just had one chapter of their life that's lasted for the last 25 minutes, because everything changes and everything moves and everything is in constant flux. And even people that you think, you know, have been just doing the same thing for years, you know, there's so many things going on behind the scenes that I don't think that, you know, you there are so many things beyond your control. So I think it's just natural that you live your life through chapters.
So it's interesting that you say that, because I think a lot of our listeners they're like you and like me as well. I know I had a similar experience in my life. I was DJing for a decade and a half, met everyone I wanted to meet, booked a lot of the DJs and played with a lot of the DJs I wanted to meet, had my Ibiza times as well and so on. And for me, that chapter ended because I wanted it to. And the next chapter involved family and teaching DJing and working where I work now in my day job in digital DJ tips. So, you know, a lot of people like us, and also like people whose DJing has always been a passion but has always been a hobby, and they've always had, say, a career, something a bit more high-flying, something a bit more expected of them, maybe a bit more conventional. They think that the kind of people that you interview, the kind of career DJs, the names they've heard of, live this kind of linear life where they discover it early on, it's awesome, and it continues that way, you know, up until the present. And I guess what I'm hearing from you is that, you know, having met and talked to a lot of these people, that just isn't the case, and that everyone has chapters and changes and things going on, because that's life. So it's a bit of a myth to think that you know, success is just one homogenous thing that you either choose to go for full time or you don't, and you live this kind of normal life. Is that kind of like the experience of having interviewed, as you say, well over 100 DJs of all types that you take away from it?
Yeah, most definitely. And it's not even just the DJs that I interview. It's, you know, we're we're constantly, and I say we because we've got a Department of Artist Relations here at Pioneer, where we're constantly meeting and training artists. And training just isn't just this does this, that does that. You know, there's a degree of spending one-on-one time with these artists and finding out what's making them tick, what's frustrating them, not only about the product, but just about touring life in general. I think that there's a whole manner of different aspects that go together to the way that these guys live their lives. And I think one thing that's really important is that, you know, I think you can look it up, that it's a well sort of worn meme that if you look at the success line that's kind of told by the media, it's on a chart, it just goes from the bottom left up to the top right, and it's a really arrow straight line, and that depicts success in most people's eyes. But what actually happens is that it's a really wiggly line with, as I said, like crushing highs, crushing lows, where things change all the time. And particularly, I mean, you know, DJs, we're in the same world as musicians, we're in the same world as actors, we're working within the creative industries, and we're working in places where things beyond our control are completely subjective, and we can't second guess these things. And no one's got the formula, no one understands the rules, because everything's constantly changing.
It's good to hear you say that, and interesting that your current role involves a kind of coaching aspect. It's kind of flipped around. You're coaching the people who've been through what you went through before. So I want to ask you about your current role, because what is it about what you do now exactly that marries together all the things you love? And maybe you can explain, because people will have heard you on the online radio shows and on your podcast, they will have heard you there, but maybe they don't understand the deeper role that you play within Pioneer DJ, whose brand is on the radio show. So maybe you can explain a bit about your job, and then tell us what it is that really appeals to you, what things it's marrying together for you that mean it's a sticker.
Well, I have three roles, and one of them is DJ Sounds, so that's writing, directing, and producing the DJ Sounds documentaries. And then there's producing and presenting the DJ Sound Show, the mix show with the overhead camera that, you know, we invite the DJs on to play. Then there's my artist relations role. So I handle artist relations for Pioneer in this kind of territory. And then the last role is that I'm a consultant for the global video department. So any tips and tricks or how-to videos, performance videos, any launch videos, ad campaigns, anything video orientated that Pioneer pushes out globally, I'm play a part as a consultant. So, you know, going back to kind of my education, I've got a degree in fine art, and ultimately, you know, that's just not painting pictures, but for me it's a degree in creativity. And thinking outside the box and looking at stories, looking at concepts and how you can depict things, you know, maybe in a visual way, but also in a conceptual way. So, you know, that is my background. And so then that married with music and technology and DJing and, you know, and then the other thing that I love is I love people. I love meeting people. I love hearing people's stories. I love interacting with people. I love talking, as my wife would probably laugh out loud at. So, you know, marrying all those things together, you know, it is a dream.
So you say that you are a video consultant, and actually you once got into the top 20 VJ chart, which I'm going to guess was quite a short-lived chart. But anyway, DJ Magazine ran this VJing chart. So tell us about your background in video DJing or VJing. What was that all about?
Again, that kind of happened by accident. It must have been like early 2000s, and I just started kind of testing and working with the product planning guys. My first product was the CDJ 1000 Mark II, and they then started showing me other things, and they showed me the DVJ, which was like a CDJ, but instead of being able to just scratch and loop audio, you could scratch, loop, and mix video. And at the time, you know, DVDs is still relatively new format, and the idea that you could scratch your DJ tracks and mix them and loop them was insane. You know, this was pre-laptops, this was pre, you know, kind of YouTube and everything like this. And so what I started, this really appealed to like the fine art, the visual side of my brain. And I started creating visuals to my DJ tracks as a way of standing out as an artist. So, you know, like these days, you know, everyone says, oh, you've got to have your angle. You know, are you the crazy guy on social media? Or, you know, are you the person that, you know, wears a mask? Or, you know, this was my angle, that if you booked me to play at your club, then you would not only hear great music, but you would hear, you would see visuals, custom-made visuals for the music that I was playing. And so, yeah, at that point, I played loads of different places and got booked for loads of different things. Like, I had this residency at the Ministry of Sound in Singapore, which I did every other month. And I did a special show there because they had amazing video screens. I played the closing at Space in Ibiza, I think, the opening and closing for a number of years. And that was obviously amazing because, you know, LED walls were starting to become a thing. And, you know, and then I was playing, like, I did Glastonbury and Sonar downstairs, like Sonar by Day and The Big Chill. And so, yeah, I had a real ball just playing visuals. And I think that kind of that momentum led to building up a bit of awareness of what I was doing, and hence that short-lived DJ Mag chart.
That's awesome. So who were you a fan of at the time in that area? I remember seeing DJ Yoda, and obviously he's still very much known for the way he kind of scratches and DJs with visuals. But who else is stood out and is maybe still standing out in that area?
I mean, it's kind of strange because I think nowadays, big LED screens surrounding a DJ just seems like, well, why haven't you got them? You know, at these big events. And, you know, people would stand out if they didn't have them. But back then, you know, it was a really big deal, and you can make a really big statement. So, you know, guys that really stood out, I mean, I think Sander Kleinenberg was a really, really interesting, fascinating artist. And I worked with the same visual artist that produced his they were called DVJ tracks. And I worked with him, and I learned a whole load of stuff off his visual artist, who was called Mark Pistor, this guy from the Netherlands. And you know, it just felt really exciting. It felt really fresh because no one was doing this, you know. Whereas now, with, you know, what Daft Punk did and what Deadmau5 did, which was basically just kind of completely and utterly redefine what a visual show could be, along with the Chemical Brothers, Massive Attack, what these visual shows could be for a DJ. But I think what I loved about DJing or DVJing was the idea that they were still DJ tracks, and that you can play them in any order, rather than a Chemical Brothers live show or a Daft Punk live show, that this kind of fused the element of like DJing and what you were seeing on screen matched up with the music. So yeah, it's really exciting. I mean, it's really simplistic to do that now, and a lot of DJs work with really highly acclaimed visual artists to create their sets, so it's really matured. But yeah, back then it was really interesting.
So that brings me nicely onto a question about the way DJing's developed, and this is a funny one because I think there hasn't been any, in inverted commas, youth culture that has lasted for 30 years before. They've kind of all died out and been replaced with something new. And yet DJing, club culture, mixing, scratching, and the whole scene around it has endured. And I feel that there is a battle, if you like, between those people who kind of expect it to stay how it was in the first 18 months that they were going out, which could be back as far as, you know, from this wave back to the early, to the late 80s, early 90s, and people who say, oh, come on, the times move. And the times have moved, haven't they? We have festival DJs who are doing very much what you described. They're playing pre-recorded, if not pre-recorded, then pre-sequenced sets, which have to be that way because they're tied into very clever visuals and pyrotechnics and so on. And it's a show with recorded music at its heart. And to some people, that's terrible. And to other people, it's awesome. But we've kind of seen the whole thing happen. What's your view on the way the whole lot's developed from those early days of DJing with vinyl in small clubs through what you've seen and what you've done, being a pioneer to an extent of this kind of this new way of performing? And then, of course, your job now interviewing a lot of this new generation. What's your view, and I'm asking you personally, subjectively, as to how it's all developed? Was it better back then? Has it kind of lost its way? Is it still awesome? What's your take on it?
I love it. I love where we've got to, you know, and I feel really proud and really happy and... You know, yeah, really proud and happy of my roots in the past, but I also feel so excited by where we're at now, you know, and the fact that it has lasted so long. And we didn't know how long this was going to last. And I say we, you know, I didn't have any kind of hand in it. I've just been pulled along by it. But, you know, I think it's in a great place now. You know, I think people tend to overlook that when it first started, or, you know, when the kind of rave culture or going out to clubs first started, it kind of wasn't, yeah, sure, there was an explosion, but there were so many kind of like negatives towards it. You know, you had to live in a big city. It was relatively dangerous. There was... You know, the barrier to entry was pretty high. You know, it's difficult. You know, everyone could have a go, but actually kind of getting out there and getting involved, it was quite difficult. Whereas now I think that there's so much information, there's so much music out there, there's so many events out there, there's so many like-minded people that you can connect with, that I think that, you know, going back to your original point, that it's never going to be like the first 18 months when you go out. No, it's not. You know, and those are, you know, for me, those times really kind of resonate with me. But at the same time, I was thinking back the other day, like with each year that's gone by, you know, what really stands out. And I could still remember, you know, definite kind of peaks through most of the years of things that I've, you know, music that I've discovered or favorite DJs, and I love finding new. And I think that that's something that some people overlook, is the fact that a lot of electronic music, you know, is about things which are new, you know, whether that's new music new DJs, new places to go out, new ways of finding music, new ways of playing music, new ways of DJing. And I think it's all great.
That's great. Well, thank you very much, Dan Tate, DJ Sounds presenter, producer and presenter of documentaries, artist relations guy, video consultant, all round music renaissance man. Dan, it's been really great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being so generous with your time today. And this has been Tales from the Dance Floor. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me, Phil. All the best. Thank you. Goodbye.